Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the war on crime and how concerns about crime have changed American life and also American government over the last few decades, at least going back to the late 1960s. And our guest for the program is Jonathan Simon. He is Associate Dean of Jurisprudence and Social Policy and Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley, and is the author of a book that explores this subject. And if you'd like to read more and go into greater depth than we can here in the next hour, you should look at the book that's titled is Governing Through Crime. And the subtitle, I think, really tells you where he's coming from on the subject. The subtitle is How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And it makes the argument that, among other things, this concern with crime has helped to enlarge the power of the executive branch of government, not only at the level of the national government and the president, but also on the state level. It has enlarged the power of governors. It has enhanced the power and the prestige and the image of prosecutors, while interestingly enough, at the same time, diminishing the image and the power of courts and judges. And it has helped to create a climate in which, perhaps to one degree or another, almost everyone considers himself or herself a potential victim of crime. Questions are certainly welcome as we move through the next hour. The only thing that we ask of people who call in is that people are just brief in their comments, and that we certainly ask that just so that we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep the program moving along. But certainly, the program is open to your questions and comments. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally here for Champaign-Urbana listeners and residents, again, 333-9455. And if you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet, in fact, you may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. And Professor Simon, hello. Professor Simon, hello.
Good morning, and good morning to my home state of Illinois.
Well, I guess I didn't know that. Glad to have you with us. I know that you were at one time taught at Michigan, so you at least were in the...
That's right. Ooh, I was born on the south side of Chicago.
Well, pleased that you could give us some of your time. I think that you, in the introduction to the book, argue that say that in you're certainly through your title and subtitle, you're trying to be provocative, and admit that it might be just a step too far, and at the same time, one cannot deny, and as you certainly point out in the book, that in so many facets of American politics and in the mind of so many Americans, crime has become an extremely important issue. Now, perhaps in some people's minds in recent years, it's been replaced by fear of terrorism. But in some interesting ways, those two things go together, I suppose.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you were doing your very apt summary of the book, you know, I was thinking many of these terms, especially about the executive, are ones that we're used to now using about the war on terror. There's a sense that America got changed, and especially the way we govern America, got changed in a rather profound way by 9/11. And that seems to be shared by both supporters of the present administration and those that are more critics of it. And I think there's a deep insight there. Something did change, but in the book I try to suggest it was really an intensification and an extension of this war on crime that had really gone on for four decades. We're about to celebrate 1968, this coming 08 year. There'll be a lot of attention on it, and that was in some ways the year that this paradigm, if you will, took off, and it came at the end of a very tumultuous period in which, among other things, the American homicide and generally violent crime rate had doubled, along with the spectacle of, you know, a great amount of violence in American cities, ranging from the assassination of presidents and civil rights leaders to civil disorders like riots. And all of this really got condensed around the image of crime. So it's In a way, it's not at all surprising that crime, in a sense, remains this profound category for us. It's almost like a retina burn on our collective imagination. The problem is that it prevents us from seeing a lot else that is going on in our environment and the issues that we need to face as a polity, whether at the state and local level or at the national level. I notice you're talking next hour about environmental change and risk, and that's a big issue for me. I mean, living here in the Bay Area with a major earthquake system underneath us, having all of us watched what happened in New Orleans with Katrina, there's a great deal that this country needs to do to prepare itself for the risks of the 21st century, and I fear that our obsession with crime really obstructs that.
And do you, well, I know that you do, you also make the argument that in addition to the kinds of things that government and people in government have done that might indeed address crime directly, you also make the argument that there have been cases where in the guise of dealing with the problem of crime, that what people have done is actually they have had other kinds of agendas that they were trying to get at, and their main intention didn't really have anything to do with crime. It really had something to do with something else, and yet when they talked about why it was they were doing what they were doing, it was still about the war on crime.
Yeah, I think that's right. It would be, in a sense, it would be bad enough if our collective obsession with crime and the way that that's been politically manipulated to expand sort of produced really bad criminal justice policies and perhaps really expensive ones. But I'm really concerned that it's bled over into the way that we govern other areas. And it's not really as conspiratorial as it might sound. I think that once crime became a kind of defining legitimate purpose for government action, and a space in which both politicians and voters, in a sense, felt that they were acting on common and good ground, it's kind of natural that, in a sense, everybody with an agenda to want to carry out something, to get something done in government or in some ways in life, would find that the crime category an important one to invoke. So to take an example, the Civil Rights Movement, which accomplished a great deal in America between the 50s and the 60s and even into the 70s, if you look at what their what's happened to their kind of policy agenda, probably the thing that's loomed largest in the last couple of decades has been hate crime legislation. And I think that's a good example of how civil rights leaders have recognized that that's probably the most promising way for them to achieve legislative successes. But, of course, it comes at the cost of veering their agenda in a toward a focus on crime.
Mm-hmm. And just one other, you make a number of, I think, interesting points to take one slightly out of order in which you deal with the book. I'm interested in this argument that you make that over time, if you look at American history at various periods, you have what you might say is the idealized citizen. Who is the person that seems to be at the core of the country? And for example, in Jeffersonian times, it was the yeoman farmer. And perhaps when we get into the period of the New Deal, it's the working person. It's the industrial worker. And so you make the argument that now, in fact, as far as government is concerned, that you might well say that the idealized American is the crime victim.
That's right. And, I guess I hadn't studied my history well enough, but I always thought the yeoman farmer idea was kind of rhetorical. But when I began to look a little more closely at the kind of legislation that Congress had enacted in the 19th century, I realized that a number of historians had pointed out a lot of it was about land, giving away land. There was an abundant amount of federally controlled land in the Western territories, and in a sense, Congress governed by giving land to people, making them landowners, enacting that kind of citizenship, and also trying to accomplish other objectives by encouraging people to, say, improve land as a condition for receiving it. So it became a real way of achieving change and progress in some ways in America. And so these idealized citizen subjects, as it were, whether they're the freedmen of the post-Civil War period or the industrial workers of the New Deal period, in a sense, they work because they do capture important features of American society, important needs that American society has. And so it's not surprising that we have them or that they kind of guide our politics. What concerns me is that, in a sense, the crime victim, rather than becoming one among many sort of images of American need, has in some ways become a premier one beyond what these earlier idealizations were able to accomplish. And it does so in a way that tends to kind of compel all of our other needs to come forward as much as they can in the frame of the crime victim. Mm-hmm.
Well, if it, you know, having said all that, I would expect, though, that perhaps at least in people's minds, they consider themselves, you know, the potential for being a crime victim is there. And I would expect that it would be greater with people who live in urban areas than in rural ones. And then, in fact, if we went out and we started asking people, we could find numbers of people who would say they had either been a victim of crime or a family member had, or a friend, or something that they know. I mean, if you actually look at crime statistics and you look at who has been a victim of crime, during this period that we're talking about, you know, over the last 30 years or so, what can you say about the rates of crime and the likelihood that any one of us would indeed be a victim of a crime?
Yeah, no, it's a very complicated picture on the statistical level. Let me take a step back for a moment and note that you know, there is a deep truth to the idea that we're all potential crime victims. Obviously, it's a truism, and we often don't have access to really accurate information of how likely that is. What's interesting to me is that a great deal of government action, and I don't even study the media, which would also duplicate this really in even more intense ways. A lot of what government has done over the last 40 years is make information available to you to make yourself recognizable to yourself as a potential crime victim. Knowledge about child abductions flashed by smart signs on highways. There's a law that mandates that universities like the University of Illinois or here the University of California collect crime statistics about crime on campus and send that usually in the form of emails or other kinds of dissemination to students, prospective students, faculty. Now, of course, none of this is by itself a bad idea. I mean, most of us want more information about the risks that we face. But when we think about it compared to the other kinds of risks we face, it's very difficult to find out, you know, what your cancer risk is in your particular university. You know, should you be living next to this lab or that? It's much easier to find out about crime. Now, what do we know about all our actual risk? I mean, one of the gains, if you will, of the war on crime has been that it's produced this abundant amount of information about it. Those trends suggest that basically in the late 60s, the period we were just talking about, American society lurched into a period of higher violent crime rates. They've gone up and down. They went down a bit in the 1970s. They famously went up again in the 1980s with the crack cocaine epidemic. We've just come off of a decade of the 90s in which we had dramatic crime declines, violent crime declines, in almost every region of the country, some more than others. Now there's a bit of an uptick in some cities, but not others. Throughout this period, however, what's important to keep in mind is that real risk of violent crime has been extraordinarily unequal. Basically, being young, being a minority, being a male, living in an inner-city area puts you at much, much, much higher risk of crime, which points up an interesting feature of the war on crime. Often we emphasize the ways in which it separates Americans, putting some in prison, others in gated communities. But and that's true and very worrisome. But the other side of it, it is about an identification, really, with the crime victim in a way that often it has a virtuous quality of being concerned about people who are actually in very different circumstances than we are. The downside of it is the strategies that we've then used to try to fight crime, mostly tough prison sentences and building more prisons, don't really have much impact on violent crime in those neighborhoods where it's hitting hardest.
Mm. Just quickly, for anybody who might have just joined us, I'd like to introduce again the guest, Jonathan Simon. He's professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley, where he is also associate dean in the Jurisprudence and Social Policy Program. He is the author of the book Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. It's published by the Oxford University Press. Questions? Welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So you've talked about a number of things, and the next I wanted to move to, one of the things I think is interesting is how the war on crime has enhanced the power of the executive branch of government, particularly when it comes to governors, state governors. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting feature of post-war American history that the governor, which really who loomed over American politics in many ways in the first century and a half or so of the American Republic, most of our presidents in the 19th century came from the governorship. by the early 1960s, there had really been governors had really been eclipsed by federal politicians, mostly because of the New Deal and the Cold War, which made the national government very, very important. Lou Harris, the great pollster, actually wrote an article in 1959 looking at the emerging 1960 presidential race. The title of his article was "Why a Governor Can Never Be President." Of course, since 76, almost all of our presidents have been governors, and I argue in the book it partly reflects the fact that the war on crime gave a great deal of new influence to governors. Most crime and most criminal law exists at the state level. Actually, most crime exists at the local level, but it's governed by laws that exist at the state level. The federal government has done a lot to try to expand its hand, mainly through the war on drugs, but still most crime, and of course the crime that people are most worried about, like violent crime, homicides, rapes, are state law issues. And so that has given the governor a much more prominent role in American politics. It's also pushed the governor, who in the 1960s, a lot of our governors, especially nationally prominent ones, were sort of little presidents, sort of New Deal figures who tried to be involved with building up higher education, highways, infrastructure, etc. The governors, really since the 70s, have positioned themselves very much as crime fighters, sort of, I call them prosecutors in chief. Often they don't actually have any power to prosecute people, but they do have power to grant or deny clemency in death penalty cases, to certainly use the bully pulpit to talk about crime. And a lot of our governors have, the most recent and most famous of which, of course, is George W. Bush, whose success as governor of Texas was very much tied to tough policies on juvenile crime and issues like that.
Mm-hmm. And it's also what has happened is that the power and the prestige and the image of the prosecutor has become enhanced. And now I find myself thinking just how many prosecutors have used that as a platform to move to higher political office.
Indeed. I mean, the prosecutor is a fascinating figure in American institutions. It's a very unique institution globally. Traditionally, you know, most countries, prosecution decisions are made by bureaucrats at essentially a national, governmental, ministerial level. America has always had a tradition of locally elected, mostly executive branch officials who make prosecutorial decisions on a local level. They've always been very important political figures, and they were often stepping stones to higher careers. One thinks of somebody like Thomas Dewey, who went from being a prosecutor to governor of New York to eventually a candidate for president. The difference in the past was that, by and large, they left behind their prosecutor persona and role once they moved to higher office. Now, actually, I think a lot of our executive officials find that a very legitimating posture, and we'll see this year with Giuliani in the presidential race, an example of somebody who's actually used it at the mayoral level, which is even a harder place to make a nationally prominent picture. But Giuliani is certainly a strong candidate because of his kind of crime-fighting persona.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have a caller here to bring in. We have a couple of them, so let's do that, starting with someone in Champaign and on our line one. Hello.
Hello. First question I have is war on crime. Is that pretty much synonymous with what politicians use as their mantra today? Let's get tough on crime and use that to catapult them into a successful pursuit of a political office. Is that pretty much the same thing, this let's get tough on crime policy? Is this war on, part of the war on crime?
That has absolutely been one of the most prominent features of it. You certainly have recognized that across the political spectrum. We often kind of think that that's a Democrat versus Republican divide, but at least since Bill Clinton, and I would argue well before that, Democrats were very good at being tough on crime as well as Republicans. And actually, liberals like Robert Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson back in the 60s were some of the first people to really ratchet up America's attention to crime. But what I would add I think what's widely recognized to be the prominence of tough on crime in electoral politics is that it doesn't stop at the end of the election. Once people get into office, they find that crime is generally an issue in which it's easiest for them to make coalitions and successfully lead. And so it tends to have a disproportionate impact on our governmental agenda as well as our electoral rhetoric.
And one other point, I know you have a caller waiting, to show how even at the local level, this get tough on crime has, in my opinion, a adverse effect on the administration of criminal justice. That is, I've lived in three different and distinct communities, Little Rock, Arkansas, Cincinnati, Ohio, and now Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. And what I've noticed as a common thread is generally the circuit judges, which are the trial court judges of general jurisdiction, who exercise criminal jurisdiction more often than not, were former prosecutors or assistant prosecutors.
Indeed. I mean, one of the the dynamics that has been most prominent in recent decades in criminal justice has been generally the withering away of judicial authority. Judges are the figures in our political institutional system that have probably fared the worst in the war on crime. And it's partly because all the things that judges are about, neutrality, distance, rationality, and lack of emotion, all are problematic in the world of the war on crime, where we tend to be very identified with the experience of victims. We want people to demonstrate emotional commitment to that. And you'll see politicians, you know, do that, whether it's passing the Patriot Act without reading it or basically sounding out on issues in a very emotional way. Judges tend to look illegitimate from this point of view, and that's led to the fact that that has created a situation where the people with the best opportunity to become judges and to sustain themselves, because judges are often elected in America, are prosecutors, because they come in there with the legitimacy of having stood tough on crime before they became a judge.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. I think that it's, I'm sure that it's also true that going hand in hand with this idea that judges somehow aren't tough enough, that in a lot of places what they've done is they've passed legislation, mandatory sentencing legislation, that has taken sentencing discretion away from judges, so that there are now many cases in which judges really have no choice about what sort of sentence they hand out.
No, I think that's true. I mean, most of these mandatory sentence laws are about basically mistrust of judges, or they get galvanized by that sense, and it really comes from this this emotional experience we have of crime that demands a kind of visible identification with the victim, and of course that's just inconsistent with our tradition of common law judiciary.
We have another caller. This is here in Urbana, where we are, line number 2. Hello.
Yeah. Good morning. Very interesting and timely discussion, I think. One of the reasons is there was a new report that was just issued, I believe, last week, called Unlocking America. Have you heard about that yet?
I have. I haven't been able to study it in detail.
Yeah, by the JFA Institute, and it really does coincide and correlate with a lot of the information I read on your blog and stuff. So I think that's an interesting report, and one of the things that they point out is basically we can't afford to keep locking people up for things that, you know, people doing crimes that really aren't, you know, a threat to the community as a whole, that don't have victims. And in fact, victimless crime is one of the ways that they intend to address this issue.
Well, I agree with you that what some of us in criminology call mass incarceration, which is a combination of traditional American prison plus a tendency to put whole groups of people in prison based on conduct that we feel alarmed by, whether it's a drug dealing, whether it's a possession of weapons, has led to a situation where really we have catastrophic situations administratively. Here in California, we have a prison system that has 180,000 prisoners now in the prisons that were designed for 100,000. Courts are getting ready to force some kind of population reduction because, you know, it's essentially a human rights crisis. They've estimated about one inmate a week dies from some kind of untreated but treatable medical condition like asthma. So it's a really brutal situation, comparable in many ways to Guantanamo. A lot of people don't know about it. And it is, in a sense, an inevitable result of a politics of fear that starts with the assumption that anybody that could somehow threaten us, we better preemptively lock them up now. And unfortunately, fortunately, it's not a sustainable strategy. We're really, in California, we've gone from spending about 5% of our overall budget back in, say, 1980 on prisons, and about 20%, by the way, on higher education, to now spending more on prisons than higher education. Eventually, we'll have to choose between medical care, retirement, and prisons. And I think at that point, we may actually be at the end of this prison building mania.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, it's not sustainable also because prisons breed crime in a way and breed violent crime where there might not otherwise be it when we lock up people who essentially have no intention of committing violence. I think one of the things that the Unlocking America report also brings up is that it's sort of a continuation of the culture wars, and this is something that's very interesting. These incarceration rates really jumped after African Americans, you know, gained full legal equality, and now we find that they're also the folks who make up the majority of prison populations. One of the things also, and just to point out how this works, is things like recreational drugs, and they recommend actually decriminalizing all recreational drugs at that level. But one of the things most interesting, I think, is marijuana, because there's still, I think, something like 800,000 arrests every year. Even though you talk to law enforcement professionals, they say, yeah, this is, you know, low priority. But the fact of the matter is they still, you know, put a lot of problems for a lot of people by simply doing this. And, in fact, knowing a lot of people that happen to engage in smoking marijuana, for instance, most of those people would just as soon not associate with any criminals any more than any other people, at least violent criminals, because that's nothing but something that's going to cause trouble. So, you know, I think it's one of these things where police come across it quite frequently. People associate it in their minds with, you know, criminal behavior, because that's when police come across it, somebody who actually engages in a crime. But, you know, 98% of people who use marijuana really have no intention and never likely will engage in any sort of violent crime that, you know, would hurt somebody else. So that's probably all I wanted to say. But I think it's an interesting point on how this sort of self-perpetuating mess that we're in here, socially and financially.
Right. Thank you very much. Well, thank you. Two extremely complicated issues on the table I just want to touch on briefly, and hopefully we can continue to talk about them. One is race, and there's just nothing bigger in this issue in some ways than race, the way that the war on crime has really exacerbated many of the alarming features of America's racial legacy, especially segregation and the disadvantaging of African Americans. One of the, I think, deep ironies is that it began, or the war on crime, in a sense, right in the midst of what were really the successes of the civil rights movement. That's led a lot of my colleagues who kind of look at this to conclude that in some ways it was a switch in time, that in some ways segregationists, as it were, switched their strategy from fighting on issues like schools and segregation to making a war on crime and a tough on crime approach to keep African Americans in their place. I have a somewhat less, pessimistic view of it in this sense. I think that a lot of the motivation behind the war on crime actually comes from a virtuous desire on the part of Americans to secure the well-being of their families, one that cuts across race. I mean, look at Philadelphia right now, where a mayor has just been elected who is really a fairly obscure council member on a tough-on-crime platform because they have a very alarming murder rate. It's a predominantly African-American voting population now. He's an African-American mayor, and most of his competitors were. So the irony is, I think, that the criminal justice system now is one of our most race-producing or racism-producing institutions, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the values of American society. In fact, I would say that it's really at loggerheads with the values that the majority of Americans have on race. And that's an opportunity, I think, for those of us that want to try to talk Americans into reassessing some of these policies.
Yeah, I think I'm glad we got to this point because the issue of the numbers of people in prison in the United States is certainly an important consequence of the war on crime. And just to put some numbers on it, as you do in the book, you write here, if present trends continue, nearly one in 15 Americans born in 2001 will serve time in prison during their lifetimes. And broke down by race and gender, it's one in three black men, one in seven Hispanic men, and one in 17 white men will go to prison in their lifetime. Again, given the fact that nothing changes. Just going back to the exchange you had with the caller, you'd think, though, that the one thing perhaps that's likely to come along to change this is the cost to government, I guess pretty much here we're talking about state governments, of building and running prisons.
Well, I think it's a pressure that will hopefully bring American political leaders to have to engage in some discussions on the limits of it. I mean, part of the problem is that people care so passionately about security, and it's such a valorized cultural concern that people are willing to pay a lot for it, right? I mean, if you frame it as what would you pay to keep your child safe from a predator, you're going to reach pretty deep in the pocket. But we're reaching pretty deep now, and there are limits that will bring up. Just as importantly, I think, as the fiscal issue, is getting Americans to begin to think about some of the other risks that they face. We have huge infrastructural needs in America. This summer, a bridge, you know, collapsed in the middle of downtown Minneapolis. We saw that behind Katrina were disastrous failures of infrastructures that were built early in the last century. This is true all over America. We have a lot of reinvesting to do, and we're not likely to do it if one, we're prioritizing stranger danger, as it were, from individual malevolent individuals. And secondly, if we mistrust government and ourselves, because the war on crime, ironically, even though it's bolstered the legitimacy of politicians, it's led to a greater cynicism about public institutions overall, and that is disastrous. What we really need to do now is find ways to reinvest in our collective institutions.
Just a little bit past our midpoint here. I have two other callers we'll get right to, but I do again want to introduce the guest, Jonathan Simon. He is Associate Dean of Jurisprudence and Social Policy and Professor of Law at the University of California, Berkeley. Before that, he was professor at University of Miami School of Law, and before that was Assistant Professor at University of Michigan, and is the author of the book, Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. It's published by the Oxford University Press. And if you would like to go over some of his arguments here in greater depth, when you go out and take a look at the book, questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have other callers. The next is in Hoopston and on our toll free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. A very interesting show. Just joined the conversation, so I apologize if this topic was already covered. Just a quick point for your guest, and I'll ring off and listen to his comment. I was wondering if your guest, if he mentioned or could equate any sort of comparison between the out-of-wedlock rate and the crime rate. And what I'm going with this is, I believe for the African-American population, it's something like 80% of the kids are born out of wedlock, and then there was a blurb in the paper last week, I want to see USA Today, that the black population has remained fairly constant, I want to say 12 or 13%, but they are responsible for something like 93% of all the homicides in this country. And I just was wondering if your guest thought it was a systemic problem, equating that with out of wedlock pregnancies, if there was any way we could kind of stem that tide. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right.
African-Americans are disproportionately involved as both perpetrators and victims of homicide and other violent crime, much of which is concentrated among young males in the inner city. The relationship to out-of-wedlock is complicated. It's clearly not marriage itself, per se. In Sweden and other northern European countries, they also have withering marriage rates, but they don't have a lot of violent crime. What may be more relevant is, the family, or more broadly, social networks that help to support children and young people. One of the ironies of the war on drugs, which the past caller brought up, is that it's led us to remove lots of people disproportionately from inner-city African-American and Latino communities who we may view as criminals because they're breaking the law and they're selling drugs, but within their local setting, in their family, in their community, they may be serving a very positive role. They may be taking care of kids. They may be looking after elderly people, and they may actually be using some of their ill-gotten gains to actually sustain local life. When we take those folks out and lock them up in a prison, we may or may not have an impact on our drug problem, probably not, but we're definitely having an impact on the ability of that local community to sustain itself. And Todd Clear has a recent book out, which I strongly recommend, called Punishing Communities, where he looks at this quite rigorously as a social scientist. And what he finds is that communities that, in a sense, lock up too many people, especially for drug crimes, tend to eventually have worse violent crime problems, because the sort of brothers, uncles, cousins that would be moderating young people, even if there's no wedded husband in a setting, are removed. And in a sense, you've got a fragmented social community.
All right. We'll go on here. The next caller is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
I'm calling about email and phone privileges. Specifically in California, there was something a while back within the last year about that gang members and even convicted terrorists have email privileges, and gangs writing codes, and others may be using non-English languages, and that only 2% of them were like checked to begin with, or let alone translated. And I find this utterly amazing that this is allowed in this day of warrantless wiretapping on virtually anybody else.
I don't know any details on that. I do have to just jump at the link between gang members and terror, because I do think that there is a kind of emotional link there in the way we've come to view gangs in America. Even before 9/11, before we had terror as a category really in our common discourse, you know, we viewed gangs in many ways as kind of homegrown terrorists. We didn't really use that word, but I argue that it's really very much rooted in this war on crime idea. I mean, gangs have existed at least since the 19th century, probably even earlier, and have always been endemic features of young people, young life in American cities. We began to see them as a really alarming, threatening kind of force in the 1960s, and it's partly, I think, out of the metaphor of the war on crime itself, because if you're having a war, you need an enemy, and gangs look a lot like an enemy. They seem to have loyalty to a common cause of malevolence, as it were. Part of the problem, though, is that we don't really know what people mean when they say they're gang members. You'll read statistics like 100,000 Crips or 100,000 Bloods in America, but what that identification actually means is capturing an enormous amount of variation, and most of the crimes that you hear of as being, quote, gang-related, if you actually go down and find out, well, what happened, there's always some underlying dispute between actual individuals, and the gang doesn't necessarily shed much light on that. So I would just caution listeners to be skeptical about the way gangs are used as a sort of frame for describing crime, and always ask yourself, what are the actual crimes, who was involved, why did they do it?
All right, again, we'll go to another caller, and this would be Charleston, line 2. Hello?
Hello? You still there?
Is caller there, Charleston, line 2?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, uh-huh, go ahead.
Yeah, I was reading a lot about prisons over the years on the war and crime, and I remember that they were toughing up the conditions, like eliminating stereos and TVs in the cells, going from hot lunches to sack lunches type of thing, doubling up cells instead of single cells, you know, and just making, you know, prisons a prison instead of, you know, like a country club. And I remember back in the, you know, 70s, there was an article, no, this is back in the 80s, there was an article in the Tribune about, you know, how horrible it was in the Stateville prison that an inmate had, and he had a big 27-inch Sony Trinitron in his cell, and they said that was such horrible conditions.
Well, I don't know, Professor Simon, can you address that at all? Because I suppose that there is indeed the perception that somehow, or at least there has been the perception, I think, on some people's part, that somehow prison is not tough enough, and that somehow what we need to do is make prison life behind bars, even more unpleasant than it already is, taking away whatever kind of privileges that you can grant inmates.
I think, you know, that it was very popular starting in the 80s to hope, in a sense, that if we could only make prison a clear and tough enough signal, as it were, a deterrent, that it would begin to diminish crime rates. And criminologists will argue till the cows go home as to whether that happened or not. It's gone. We got tough in the 80s. Crime went up. Kept being tough. Crime went down in the 90s. Now it seems to be going back up. It's very hard to find the correlations. If you actually talk to the people who actually run prisons, some of these get tough policies if they mean sort of removing televisions, sports equipment, college education classes, et cetera, from prison. It raises a different issue, which is, what do you do with people once you've locked them up? And part of the problem is, you know, they call a television set, you know, an automatic guard in a way, because it provides a way of essentially occupying people's time. One of the problems is, if you aggregate a lot of people who have the vast range of problems that are usually associated with drug abuse and other things that get you involved in a criminal lifestyle, you know, you've got a real control problem in that space. And part of what we're seeing now in California, where actually the Correctional Officers Union has actually joined the inmates in seeking population reductions and major investments in rehabilitation inside the prisons, because they find it too dangerous and too disorderly a place to really do their jobs in a safe and effective way. And I think citizens have to ask themselves, all right, you know, how much do you want to bet on the deterrent signal idea, and how much are you also worried about having people released from prisons who have been held under conditions of that are very dangerous and tend to be brutalizing, and if those people are going to come back, you may ultimately regret not having a little bit more attention paid to trying to do something with them while they're locked up.
Yeah. Just again, I want to appreciate the comments of all the callers. We just have about 10 minutes left, and I'd like to see if there's anybody else would like to join in the conversation. Also, very quickly again, to introduce the guest, Jonathan Simon. He is the Associate Dean of Jurisprudence and Social Policy and Professor of Law at University of California, Berkeley, and author of the book Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. Something I'd just like to go back to for a moment, because I think it's very interesting, is how it is this almost kind of reversal of fortune when you look at the images of prosecutors and judges happened. It seemed to me that there certainly would have been a time when a judge was a very, very respected individual, someone that was thought highly of, and perhaps the prosecutor less so. How it is we got from a point like that to the point now where now it seems like all of the power is in the hands of the prosecutor. They're the person that's the tough crime fighter, and somehow we attack judges as being soft on crime. How exactly did that happen?
Well, and going back to the 60s was a moment when courts were playing a very prominent role in American society. Probably most people my age will remember the school segregation issue and desegregation as a very visible role of courts in American society. So we've had a tradition in America of courts being very important actors. And one of the things that I've really been concerned about is the way that the war on crime, by diminishing the stature of judges, by making them look untrustworthy, because they couldn't show the same kind of emotional identification with crime victims and the same kind of preemptive harshness toward criminal defendants that the war on crime sort of demands from political leaders, it's not only made them reluctant to protect rights in the criminal process, I think it's diminished them overall as actors in American society. And if you look at the role of the Supreme Court in recent decades, they've really backed out of a lot of efforts to play a role in reforming American institutions and changing American society. And that, I think, if you look at our collective history, is a real loss, because courts have played a pivotal role in many parts of our history.
Well, let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Like you say, I live in Urbana in what seems to me a very safe neighborhood that it's a privilege to live in. Every year at our block party, though, I'm impressed by groups of people, especially elderly people, who start talking about, did you hear about that break-in a couple blocks north? And, yeah, I read in the newspaper. And the perception of some people just seems to me quite far from the reality. And I had heard once that people's perceived risk of crime correlates really a lot more to how many hours of television they watch each week than with their actual vulnerability statistically. I wonder if your speaker, who I very much appreciate his opinions, would comment on that. I'll hang up. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Yeah, I think it's a big problem here that, and I'm intrigued by your comment that folks were talking about break-ins in the neighborhood, because I tend to trust local crime information when neighbors are talking to neighbors about things they actually know about rather than things they've heard on TV. I have a little more confidence, but clearly, one of the things that really happened over the last several decades is that we developed a kind of national conversation about crime, and this has come out very clearly in the survey data over the years. If you ask people, their perception of crime overall, they think it's going up no matter what's happening. Basically, even in the 90s, it took only in the last couple of years, because of more media reports, did people even recognize that crime went down dramatically in the 90s. But even during that period, when people just saw crime going up, if you ask them, well, do you feel safe in your own neighborhood, lots of people said yes, the same people who were alarmed about crime. And so what you see is a kind of a displacement of local knowledge with this kind of quasi-imaginary knowledge about crime that's fed both by the government and by media. One of the things I think we need to do as Americans is try to gather more information about the risks that we face and how we can address them. I'm very concerned about, as a parent, about the degree to which we've kind of locked down our kids in America out of a preemptive fear of sex predators and other kinds of crime. And I think it's having a really serious impact on kids in issues like childhood obesity. And so I think we can't just look to our politicians. We have to start making some of these risk selection issues our own issues.
And we have somebody calling who's in their car on our line number four. Hello.
Yeah, how are you?
Yeah.
I'm glad you're taking my call.
Sure.
Your comments about prosecutors and judges brought quick thoughts to Clint Eastwood and the Dirty Harry movies, all which appear to have that subplot about, you know, the government is letting the crooks go loose, and, you know, it's kind of up to us to keep the streets clean because the courts and prosecutors have become weak. And that was really a pervasive tone in virtually every one of the Dirty Harry movies that I can recall. And I'll take your comment off the air.
Thanks. No, I you know, I don't pay nearly enough attention in the book to popular culture, but it's almost always a good reflection of these things. And you're absolutely right that what the Clint Eastwood character there portrayed so well was that kind of one-dimensional harshness. I think there was a famous scene where he's reading it, somebody, his Miranda rights, while like, dragging him along a subway track. And that image of the lawman as a kind of relentless enforcer and protector against the kind of nimbly due process-oriented judge, very powerful one. And, you know, what really replaced, though, was an earlier American tradition of great amount of skepticism about law enforcement. If you go back and watch the Humphrey Bogart movies about private detectives, you know, back in the Marlowe days of the 30s, the private detective had to be relied on because the police couldn't be trusted. And generally the police were shown to, you know, be incompetent and corrupt. And it's not an accident that in the 1950s, when some famous studies were done of juries, the scientists concluded that juries were more skeptical of prosecution evidence than judges were. Today, that's reversed. People tend to believe what the prosecutor says and what the police say more than judges that are conducting trials do.
Well, we've got a couple minutes left, like maybe about three or four, and there are certainly some other areas that we have not gotten into. You touched just on what this means for the family, for example, and you also in the book talk about how this extends into the workplace, and if people want to go more into that, they can also take a look at the book. But before we find ourselves out of time, I guess I really should ask you now, what should we really do about all this? Is there some way, if this preoccupation with crime has been counterproductive, and certainly if it's gotten to the point where we're spending so much money locking people up that gets to the point where it's just not sustainable anymore, then the question is, what would, in your mind, what should we do?
Well, I argue in the book that, in a sense, we need to choose better and newer dangers to focus on. You know, I'd like to believe that we could just be less fear-driven, but I think there's much about American history that suggests that we tend to be motivated collectively to act together by fear. And so I suggest, you know, going back to Richard Nixon, who declared war on drugs and also war on cancer in the same period, that a war on cancer may not be a bad way to kind of mobilize American society in a way to be more sensitive to a whole range of risks, whether they're environmental risks like carcinogens in our food supply and other environmental pollutants, whether it's personal behavior risks like smoking, drinking, or other behavior that may make us more vulnerable to cancer. A war on cancer, I think, will train us and train our leaders to be, you know, responsive to a much broader network of concerns, while at the same time being less encouraging of a kind of demonizing of stranger danger. I think that stranger danger is a good two-word image that captures our tendency to pick out those dangers that we can associate with some bad guy rather than those that are more complicated and systemic.
Well, of course, the tragic and ironic thing about that old stranger danger thing that we were all taught when we were kids is the fact that statistically it's much more likely that if someone does you violence, it's somebody that you know. It may well, in fact, be a family member. So, that you know, the chances of your being the victim of a random street crime where the perpetrator doesn't know you at all, it's actually
right.
Quite low.
And you're putting your finger on something very important, which is that's partly why we buy into the war on crime, because when we view ourselves as a victim of stranger danger, there's not much for us to be responsible for. We can wait for the government to help us out. That's why I hope conservatives as well as liberals will see that this kind of obsession with stranger danger crime is very counterproductive from the point of view of both a more equal and a more responsible America.
So how do are there things about the war on crime and the way that we have been approaching in all these years that carry over into the war on what we call the war on terror?
Well, a good example is our our focus on malevolent bad guys. Obviously, we have some out there, but whether or not we can actually secure ourselves by locking up lots of potential. I mean, what we've done, if you look at how we fought the war on terror so far, is we built a series of prisons around the world. We've locked up a lot of people on the scene of places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places. And essentially, we can't figure out necessarily who the serious terrorists are. We just got a lot of people locked up. And I think that kind of strategy very much comes out of the war on crime, this idea that if we somehow can lock up enough of the kind of people that we're afraid of, then we'll somehow get out from under this. I think a much better strategy, in a sense, borrowing from the war on cancer, as it were, would be to look at site-specific risks, to look at where are the vulnerabilities in American society, whether it's power plants, whether it's levees in New Orleans that could either be destroyed by a hurricane or by a terrorist. If we actually try to bolster American society, making it secure on the ground rather than focusing on locking up preemptively as many potential bad guys as we can, I think we might actually find a more productive way and would also make us more robust against a whole range of threats.
Well, there we must stop. We've come to the end of this hour of the program. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book Governing Through Crime, How the War on Crime Transformed American Democracy and Created a Culture of Fear. It's published by the Oxford University Press by our guest, Jonathan Simon. He's professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.